Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This month, NAFTA turned 20. The North American Free Trade Agreement was signed by President Bill Clinton on December 8, 1993, and went into effect on January 1, 1994. Here is President Clinton speaking about NAFTA before signing the trade agreement.
I believe we have made a decision now that will permit us to create an economic order in the world that will promote more growth, more equality, better preservation of the environment, and a greater possibility of world peace. We are on the verge of a global economic expansion that is sparked by the fact that the United States at this critical moment decided that we would compete, not retreat. In a few moments, I will sign the North American Free Trade Act into law. NAFTA will tear down trade barriers between our three nations. It will create the world's largest trade zone and create 200,000 jobs in this country by 1995 alone. The environmental and labor side agreements negotiated by our administration will make this agreement a force for social progress as well as economic growth. I believe.
That is President Clinton speaking about NAFTA before he signed the trade agreement. So 20 years later, how has NAFTA affected the lives of American, Canadian, and Mexican workers? On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on NAFTA's effects on workers and labor and environmental conditions here at home and in Mexico. One of today's guests, Gerardo Otero, writes that Mexico's asymmetrical integration into the North American economy, combined with neoliberalism, has had a detrimental impact on its food self-sufficiency, its labor sovereignty, and substantially increased its out-migration rates. Gerardo Otero is professor of sociology and an associate member of the School for International Studies at Simon Fraser University. He's author of Food for the Few, Neoliberal Globalism and Agricultural Biotechnology in Latin America, and he joins us from Mexico City. Hi, Gerardo. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And Tim Wise is director of the Research and Policy Program at the Global Development and Environmental Institute at Tufts University. He leads its Globalization and Sustainable Development Program. He's co-author of Confronting Globalization, Economic Integration and Popular Resistance in Mexico, and The Promise and the Perils of Agriculture Trade Liberalization Lessons from Latin America. And Tim joins us from Boston. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And Harley Shaken is professor of social and cultural studies at the Graduate School of Education, director of the Center for Latin American Studies, and a member of the Department of Geography at UC Berkeley, where he specializes on issues of work, technology, and global production. And Harley joins us from Berkeley. Hi, Harley. Welcome back.
Very nice to be here.
Great to have you. So, Harley, I want to start with you because you were actually involved in the NAFTA debates in Washington in the early 90s. Give us a little history lesson, because NAFTA was signed by President Clinton, but President Reagan actually first started the campaign for NAFTA. Can you talk a little bit about where it first originated?
Sure. The origins of NAFTA are a bit surprising. The U.S. had been pushing free trade since the end of World War II, but it was actually Carlos Salinas, after being elected president of Mexico in a very contested election in 1988, that made the first move. Shortly after his election, he reportedly went to Davos, Switzerland, with the interest of attracting new investment to Mexico. He found much of the attention focused on Eastern Europe. He thought he needed to do something dramatic. He suggested NAFTA, put it on the agenda. President George H.W. Bush could hardly say no to that, and the Prime Minister of Canada, who had already signed a free trade agreement with the U.S., didn't want to be left out of the action. That was the beginning. It was under President Clinton that the final agreement was signed and then ratified in November of 1993.
What was the climate like in Washington? Was there a healthy debate around NAFTA? Because the House approved it 234 to 200, and the Senate approved it 60 to 38.
It was a very intense debate, and really far closer than those numbers would indicate. We have to put it in political context. It was the first year of President Clinton's presidency, and this was the first Democratic president the U.S. had had in 12 years. This became his signature initiative almost from the beginning. Yet the leading Democrats in the House of Representatives, principally Majority Leader Richard Gephardt and Majority Whip David Bonnier, and many of the Democratic caucus really opposed it because they felt it inadequately dealt with issues related to labor and the environment. So it was an unusually contentious debate in Washington, but there was another dimension of it that was a bit different. It was really the first trade debate since World War II that became a mass-based issue, because the intensity about it wasn't simply in Congress or among trade experts. It was in local union halls. It was in community centers. It was among human rights groups. It was with the environmental community. So it really began a national debate about the terms of globalization.
Mm. And Tim, what would you add to that? Because there were so many promises. Supporters said that NAFTA would create hundreds of thousands of jobs. It would bring economic prosperity to Mexico. It would greatly improve environmental and labor standards. I mean, the list is just pretty huge when you look at the promises that were made back then.
No, indeed. And particularly in light of the actual performance over 20 years, that becomes, those promises become quite stark. I mean, I remember many of us joking at the time that the NAFTA agreement was being debated so actively, as Harley describes, in Washington, that you could find a study that showed every country gaining a trade surplus with every other country, which of course is impossible because trade is indeed a zero-sum game that way. Everybody was going to win, and every sector of every country was going to win. And among the more dramatic of the promises, I think, was for Mexico, was that Mexico would be, this would really allow Mexico to enter the first world. For the U.S. promised it would end the immigration problem by creating so many great jobs in Mexico that people would want to stay home, what we would see is, you know, a fully integrated North America with Mexico being brought up to the standards of its northern neighbors. And of course, none of that happened. Mm.
Gerardo, why don't you elaborate on that a bit? Talk a little bit about the promises that were made specifically on how NAFTA would affect Mexico.
Yes. As Tim just said, one of the promises was that for Mexico there were going to be more and better paid jobs. And in fact, job growth has been a lot shorter than needed. The Mexican economy or the labor force grows by about 1.2 million on a yearly basis, and only about a third are being absorbed, you know, in the past 20 years. So what that means is that a lot of people end up in the informal sector. And in fact, the number of workers in the informal sector has actually grown in absolute terms, since 1994.
And what about how it affected the food market in Mexico? Because that often gets a lot of attention.
Excuse me, the which market?
Food. How NAFTA has affected food in Mexico.
Yes. I think that's been a very dramatic impact, because it used to be the case that peasants were focused on producing grains and cereals for the domestic market, while the more capitalized farmers were focused mostly on producing fruits and vegetables, which are, you know, more risky for peasants to produce. And fruits and vegetables were refocused after NAFTA for export. And so the U.S. and Canada have tremendously expanded the importation of fruits and vegetables, but not sufficiently to offset Mexico's growing dependency on the import of grains and cereals. And so one result is that the peasant economy went bankrupt for the most part because they were, you know, they had no chance to compete against the heavily subsidized farmers from the U.S. Communities have been disrupted. Migration grew tremendously to the United States. And I think an indirect effect is being felt now with also the growth in crime, in narco trafficking and violence. There's been a lot of loss of life as a result.
Harley, when you take a look at the effects of NAFTA, I mean, it's such a massive issue, and we specifically wanted to focus on how it has affected workers, working families, and labor. What measurements do you really use when you look at its effects?
The number of jobs that are created or lost, we have to also look at what happens to pay. And in both areas, NAFTA has been very wanting. There's one, I think, core problem at the heart of the agreement, which is it dealt very effectively with issues of intellectual property rights, corporations, profitability, et cetera, and has very strong enforcement mechanisms. But when it came to issues of labor and the environment, they were buried in very weak side agreements. And over the last 20 years, those side agreements have barely registered. So here's the core issue. In Mexico, productivity in manufacturing, and this is 80% of Mexico's exports are in manufacturing, have risen 80% since 1990, between 1994, right after NAFTA went into effect, till about 2010. 80% rise in productivity. That means each Mexican worker is producing 80% more. Total compensation, wages and benefits, adjusted for inflation, declined 20%. So you have an agreement at its core export-related area where the average worker is producing much more and earning less in real terms. That's not really a formula for economic success, but that also mirrors a very clear problem that the U.S. has had from the 1970s going forward. So in both countries, the fact that we have rising productivity and declining wages really feeds into the inequality that impacts both nations and also dampens any possible economic gain from an agreement like NAFTA.
Can you paint us a picture? What changes did you see after NAFTA was implemented? Because I remember seeing a documentary about how it affected women in Mexico, and the visuals were really good. Before NAFTA, you had a lot of electronic companies in Southern California, and then after NAFTA passed, they basically jumped the border to the other side of the fence, where they paid very low wages, and women in Mexico worked in these factories but couldn't feed their families, and so they came to the United States to find a better job. So can you sort of, what really stands out for you when you look at what really changed because of NAFTA?
Well, I think we've had on one level a dramatic expansion of trade between all three countries, but focusing on the U.S. and Mexico for a moment, total cross-border trade quintupled between 1993 and 2012. It went from about $80 billion to $450 billion. That's far faster than any proponents or critics of the agreement thought would happen at the time. Mexico, in this period, attracted a significant amount of advanced manufacturing, from the manufacture of automobile engines to computers to to sophisticated auto parts to medical equipment. Much of this has been done in the border export plants, which heavily rely on women and pay very low wages, and where it's virtually impossible to organize an independent union. So the kinds of checks and balances that could result in a broader distribution of these gains have largely been absent. And the fact that the trade agreement is silent on this, I think, has exacerbated much of the problem, really, in both countries.
That is Harley Shaken, professor of social and cultural studies at the Graduate School of Education, director of the Center for Latin American Studies, and a member of the Department of Geography at UC Berkeley, where he specializes on work, technology, and global production. Tim Wise is director of the Research and Policy Program at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University. He's co-author of Confronting Globalization, Economic Integration, and Popular Resistance in Mexico. And Gerardo Otero is professor of sociology and an associate member of the School for International Studies at Simon Fraser University. He's the author of Food for the Few, Neoliberal Globalism and Agricultural Biotechnology in Latin America. And on today's Your Call, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the 20-year anniversary of NAFTA. If you remember the debate that was had in Washington, D.C., what really struck you about what you heard in terms of the promises that were made back then? And then when we look at what we're dealing with today with a massive global unemployment problem, what are your thoughts about how things have changed? What effects have NAFTA had on labor and workers? If you've been directly impacted by NAFTA, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you are from Mexico or have family in Mexico and would like to talk about how they've been affected, you can also call us or send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org, or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Tim, what would you add to that? When you look at like the tangible changes that we've seen as a result of NAFTA, what really stands out for you?
Well, again, thinking about Mexico and my particular area of focus in a lot of my research, agriculture, I think the change in agricultural trade has been dramatic. So we experienced that in the United States by seeing fresh vegetables and fresh fruits all year round. Mm. So Mexico became a major source for winter tomatoes and strawberries and other sorts of goods. The trade-off for Mexico was that they started importing a lot more basic grains and meats. And paradoxically, it was the Mexican government that pushed, in a way, the hardest to make sure that corn was incorporated into the agreement, which afterwards negotiators would say that they didn't expect Mexico to give in on that, and Mexico came to the table ready to give it away. The Mexico, for its part, promised its producers that they would massively invest in irrigation and modernize the sector, and they never did that. But the net result of all of that is that, as Gerardo said, U.S. grains started flowing into Mexico at dramatically higher rates. You're mm-hmm. talking about 300-500% increases mm-hmm. in exports from the United States, and at prices that were below the cost of production due to U.S. agricultural policies and already coming from a more efficient agricultural sector. So Mexican producer prices, the prices that Mexican producers were receiving for their goods, fell 50, 60, 70% in real terms. That's what Gerardo is referring to about the bankrupting of the peasant sector. That for corn farmers, it was a 66% drop in producer prices. At the same time, the government was pulling back its extension programs, its support programs, its credit programs. And so it's been an absolute assault on the countryside. An estimated 2.3 million jobs have been lost in the countryside. More than that, as family members in the countryside export family members, as families export family members to cities and to the United States, seeking employment while they stay on their land with the remaining older people and children. A lot of Mexican rural towns look like old age homes and nursery schools. Because so many of the working age population has left. That's tragic and dramatic. I mean, one of the other paradoxical effects of that kind of an agreement and that kind of a migration pattern with the increased enforcement along the border, particularly after the 2001 terrorist attack in New York, is that the seasonal migration flow back and forth just really came to a halt. But migration didn't come to a halt, so migrants came and stayed, and that disrupts families permanently created a growing population of permanent illegal undocumented migrants in the United States, and that's been a dramatic effect of the agreement as well.
Well, we have a caller who has a related question, so let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for a very good program and for taking my call. Your guest has answered my question already, which was about the impact of NAFTA on the employment in the agricultural sector in Mexico. What can I say? It's very tragic. Mm. It's worse than I thought. Thank you very much. I'll stop here.
All right. Thank you. Gerardo, since this is your specialty, what else would you add to this? You are quoted in many articles saying that as a result of NAFTA, Mexicans are now actually eating more meat. A lot more canola oil is now in the food. What else can you add?
Well, I mean, something that's kind of ironic, if you look at the data from 1985 to the latest figures in 2007 or so, it turns out that in the initial period, Mexicans were actually eating more than Canadians on a per capita basis in terms of kilocalories. And in average, of course, the U.S. Was, you know, way higher than that. And what's happened between Canada and Mexico is that Canada's per capita consumption of food calories really jumped toward a convergence with that of the United States, whereas, I mean, Mexico's also increased a little bit, but on a much lower basis than the U.S. and Canada. And if you break down, you know, the total caloric food consumption, then it does appear that Mexicans are consuming more meat. And part of that is because there has been a tremendous increase in the production of chicken in Mexico based on imported soybeans and corn, which, you know, they're mostly transgenic and produced in the United States. And so and there's also been a tremendous increase in the importation of chicken from the United States. My hypothesis is that all this new chicken meat is probably being bought over by primarily middle and upper income classes in Mexico. Conversely, vegetables, as Tim mentioned, there's been a huge increase in the availability of vegetables, both for the United States, but particularly for Canada. I think Canada, on a proportional basis at least, has been the major winner in availability of fresh fruits and vegetables. Hmm. And it increased its level of daily average per capita consumption to even surpass Mexico when it was, you know, at a considerably lower basis than Mexico. So it not just equal, but surpassed Mexico. Mexico's graph is very flat. You know, there was hardly any increase, and that's because what happens when you start exporting a lot of fruits and, well, anything that you tackle the world market with, what happens is that you import the world price for those goods. And so what's happened with fresh fruits and vegetables in Mexico is that they have become more dear, you know, for the general public.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the 20-year anniversary of NAFTA. Many promises about NAFTA. The supporters said it would create hundreds of thousands of jobs and increase labor laws. According to Public Citizen, 1 million jobs have been lost, and we've seen a 580% increase in trade deficits. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Join us in today's Your Call. The number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send your email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Ay, tierra, el hijo del sol nació.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how we should adapt to a drier California. 2013 was California's driest calendar year on record. The state has yet to declare an official drought, but they are starting to urge people to conserve water. So we will talk about how we're going to deal with this in the future. And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation and get an update on Fukushima and radiation. There's a lot of headlines out there about what's really happening, so we'll bring on some scientists to get the latest. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our Agenda for a New Economy series, and we're talking about the 20-year anniversary of NAFTA. We're specifically focusing on how it has affected the lives of workers in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and we're talking also about labor conditions. Today, we're joined by Gerardo Otero, professor of sociology and an associate member of the School for International Studies at Simon Fraser University. He's the author of Food for the Few, Neoliberal Globalism and Agricultural Biotechnology in Latin America. Tim Wise is director of the Research and Policy Program at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University. He's co-author of Confronting Globalization, Economic Integration and Popular Resistance in Mexico. And Harley Shaken is professor of Social and Cultural Studies at the Graduate School of Education, director of the Center for Latin American Studies, and a member of the Department of Geography at UC Berkeley. And Harley, what about Canada? We don't really talk much about how NAFTA has affected Canada. What really stands out for you there?
Well, I think there have been important impacts, but there was a free trade agreement that Canada and the U.S. negotiated in 1988, almost 5 years before NAFTA itself went into effect. And I think also that was a much less heated issue in terms of the U.S. debate, very heated in terms of the Canadian debate, in part because it was two advanced economies relatively at the same level that were integrating more closely. In the context of both Canada or the U.S. or both and Mexico, it was a much less developed economy with two very developed economies, and that triggered a lot of the intensity about the debate in Canada and the U.S. For both countries, for the U.S. and Canada, autos has been a very central part of the of the economic integration, and that preceded even the free trade agreement between both countries. Now what we're looking at in the context of NAFTA is a huge growth of auto production, largely for export in Mexico, and much of that is most directly coming at the expense of Canada. The projections are that by 2016, Mexico will manufacture over 4 million cars a year, while Canada will manufacture about 1.9 million.
And that's because of low wages?
The low wages in Mexico.
Right.
And that, in fact, was one of the triggers of the initial debate and one of the deep concerns. That is, absent a trade agreement that really addresses effectively the right to form a union, the right to bargain collectively, and the right to strike if necessary, you really are eliminating the checks and balances that ensure that growing productivity really does translate into wages. So if you look right now, you can go to northern Mexico, the state of Saltillo. Chrysler makes Dodge Ram trucks, a very hot-selling model in the United States. These trucks go often for $35,000 or more. When comparable vehicles are produced in the U.S., senior auto workers get about $30 an hour. New entrants at a much lower rate get about $19 an hour. In Mexico, workers with very high productivity and quality get $3.20 an hour.
Wow.
So those kinds of differentials really set up some of the dynamic that squanders the possible benefits of trade. In my view, trade can be a very positive force for all three countries. Expanded trade is something that's desirable, but if you have rules of the game that don't translate those gains into a broadly shared prosperity, that is, workers and their families and communities sharing in this, you're squandering the possibilities that trade presents.
So you're basically saying it could be beneficial as long as workers are paid a living wage.
Absolutely. And that requires the institutions that are going to make sure that happens, whether government policy, whether independent unions. You need those checks and balances to translate the productive gains into better lives for ordinary people.
Have there been any positive effects of NAFTA?
Well, I think there have. I think the rapid expansion of trade, despite much of the damage that's taken place as a result in the current context, there have been gains. There have been, in certain sectors, jobs created in Mexico. But the problem is, very often, that comes at the expense of jobs in Canada or the United States. That doesn't have to happen, but if you artificially create a situation where productivity in Mexico in the new plants is comparable or even greater than in the U.S. or Canada, where quality is comparable or even greater, and that's what's very new about the current context, and you're paying wages that are a sixth to a tenth of manufacturing wages in the other two countries, then you've got a formula that's going to squander those potential gains.
And Tim, what would you say about gains?
I think you can point to very, you know, the odd thing about NAFTA for Mexico is that Mexico got, in a way, exactly what it wanted, what it said it wanted, which was a growth in trade, a growth in foreign investment, stabilizing its macroeconomic situation, which it did. Inflation came down. That's not narrowly because of NAFTA, but because of government policies associated with that larger economic model of which NAFTA is part and parcel. The budget deficits were kept fairly low, and as Harley said, productivity in manufacturing went up. So that, you know, I think the great reckoning that I think those who supported and promoted that model of economic development need to come to grips with is that failed as an economic development strategy in Mexico, for Mexico, that they got everything they wanted and it failed to generate dynamic growth. Growth rates in Mexico were relatively low compared to other growth rates in the hemisphere, and way lower than comparable middle-income countries like China, Brazil, India, even Chile. And then job growth was pitiful, and arguably what Mexico most needed from a trade agreement was job growth. Mm. And that's I think the great contradiction that, in a way, we all, as you think about the new economy, that we're all wrestling with. Now, after the financial crisis, we're wrestling with it in the developed world as well. We see economic growth without job growth, and as Harley said, with wage stagnation. Economic development in the developing world is certainly about employment generation and really the formalization of employment, bringing workers out of the informal sector and into the formal sector of the economy. And as Harley said, I think trade can be a huge tool, a very important tool in that process. So can foreign investment. China and Brazil have shown, which are now the kind of the darlings of the international development community, showing that, showing such robust growth and Brazil's progress in eradicating poverty and reducing hunger. But they didn't sign agreements like this. They opened their economies very strategically. The government stayed very involved in helping manage the economy toward the development goals of the country, and they've shown much better results.
Have we seen any trade deals that guarantee a living wage?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's anything that a trade deal is going to write in. I think the best that the side agreements and the labor provisions that have that some advocates have forced on the United States into its negotiations of trade agreements are just the incorporation of International Labor Organization standards, but not any commitment to an equalization of wages or the payment of a living wage.
And a little later in the show, we'll talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which groups like Public Citizen call NAFTA on steroids. And we've done a couple shows about that, and we'll talk about that and other trade agreements that are all based on NAFTA. And if you'd like to join us today, we're marking the 20-year anniversary of NAFTA by talking about how it has affected labor and workers specifically. And if you'd like to talk about how it's affected you, if you've got family members or anyone you know in Mexico, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. If you work in the industries that have been affected by NAFTA, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Catherine in Santa Cruz. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. As a direct result of NAFTA, hundreds and perhaps thousands of girls and young women have been victims of male violence against women along border towns such as Juarez. They cross the border to Mexico to go to work in the factories, the United States factories primarily, that have gone to Mexico because it's cheaper to do business there. And they are disappeared. They're never seen again. And this is a direct result of NAFTA. And it certainly affects workers and labor. Also, fresh is a strange word to give fruits and vegetables that have had to travel 1,000 miles, maybe thousands of miles. They're not fresh at all. Food should be grown locally, in season, where people live.
Well, thank you so much for raising these issues. Gerardo, the Mother Jones had a piece in 2002 called To Work and Die in Juarez, and they focus on the women, some as young as 13, who work for companies like General Electric, Alcoa, and DuPont. Can you give us an update on these women and girls who travel to work?
That's actually not within my area of expertise. I mean, I actually wanted to weigh in on the larger issue of wages that was being talked about in relation to trade. And I guess everybody has to agree that the original objective of increasing trade has been fulfilled, but trade has become a fetish, you know. So what if trade has been increased if it doesn't translate into prosperity for a majority of the people, right? And Tim is very right in saying that Brazil and China have performed a lot better in development, some development measurements like wages, you know, in real wages have increased by about 300% and 400% in those countries, while Mexican work wages, you know, lag way behind because of, you know, lack of compensation of increased productivity. And at the bottom of this is, of course, a huge change in the power of capital in relation to labor. You know, these possibility for capitalists to just close shop in the United States and move elsewhere, you know, where lower wages are available, you know, that has tremendously decreased workers' bargaining capacity.
Tim, have you taken a look at the issue of women who went to Juarez to work at some of these factories?
Not specifically, but I think the observation of the caller is very much on the money, just in the sense that the I mean, it's really a question, like I was saying before, of being careful what you wish for. As what Mexico got was a dramatic and quick expansion, and then actually retraction of investment and production in the maquiladora sector along the border, and that created all the kinds of things that any town has seen, towns have seen when they've seen low-wage boom towns, from pollution problems to crime problems and the rest. You combine that with a drug trafficking issue, and you get, you know, it's not surprising that we see the kinds of problems that and tragic results that we've seen in a community like Juarez. It's not, I guess I would say that it so dramatically affects women because women are so much the workforce of choice for these industries, and that in and of itself has a you know, is all about the ability to pay lower wages, to have lower protections for workers in the form of unions and other sorts of protections.
Well, thank you for calling. We actually just found another article from Forbes from 2011 that is called Enciudad Juarez, NAFTA's Grisly Legacy, which talks about exactly what you raised, Catherine. So we'll link to that on our website, and maybe we'll put it on our show list. So thanks so much for calling in. And I also wanted to ask you, since Catherine brought up fruit, maybe Gerardo, can you talk about this? I've been noticing in my corner store that there's so much more organic fruit now coming from Mexico. Cucumbers, zucchini. I just saw at least four or five different things coming from Mexico. Are the farmers benefiting from this at all? Or how does the organic industry work in Mexico?
Well, I just want to start by clarifying that I said fresh fruits and vegetables just to distinguish from industrially processed fruits and vegetables. Now, organic, I think, well, you know, that is just an adaptation to the market by well-capitalized farmers. Even if you go to Walmart, you know, you might find a section of organic food. So that, you know, by itself doesn't mean any alternative agricultural model.
That is Gerardo Otero, professor of sociology and an associate member of the School for International Studies at Simon Fraser University. He's author of Food for the Few. Tim Wise is director of the Research and Policy Program at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts. He's co-author of Confronting Globalization. And Harley Shaken is professor of Social and Cultural Studies at the Graduate School of Education, director of the Center for Latin American Studies at UC Berkeley. And today we're marking the 20-year anniversary of NAFTA. If you have any questions or comments about NAFTA and how it has affected workers and labor, we'd love to hear from you if you've got personal stories to share, if you work in any industries that have been affected. And then also, NAFTA is really used as a template for all trade agreements. So what are your thoughts about, for example, the TPP, which is being negotiated right now? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Faye just left a comment that says, please talk about how Bill Clinton has said he now regrets NAFTA. He stated that this is a Salon interview. She writes, I believe Hillary does too. Note that before NAFTA was passed, none other than Ross Perot, dyed-in-the-wool capitalist, said NAFTA was, quote, the giant sucking sound of jobs going out of the country. And Bill Clinton, a couple of years ago, said that a lot of his trade policies were, quote, a mistake. He said, quote, I had to live every day with the consequences of the loss of capacity to produce a rice crop in Haiti to feed these people because of what I did. I think my advisors were wrong, and I think I was wrong. Harley, because you were part of the debates back in the 90s, what are your thoughts on what Bill Clinton said about his trade policies?
Well, I think he may be evaluating them quite accurately. He may really feel regret. Certainly, there was a huge force at the time from the business community and from the Clinton administration to get NAFTA passed. It was viewed as an important opening and aiding a person who was perceived as a reformer, a real mischaracterization in Mexico, Carlos Salinas. So I think he has some genuine regrets. The issue becomes, how do we translate this into improved policy going forward? There's one dimension of this, though, that I think is worth mentioning. During the NAFTA debate, the whole world shrunk down to three countries, Mexico, the United States, and Canada. China was barely mentioned, if at all, as part of the debate. But China is a huge force in terms of trade in North America, especially Mexico. As we go forward today, China has emerged as Mexico's second largest trading partner after the United States. During the NAFTA debate, shortly before that, China was such an incidental thing in terms of Mexican trade, it wasn't even spelt out separately. It was a part of the category of other countries. Today, or last year, for example, Mexico exported $5 billion worth of goods to China, but imported over $55 billion for a $50 billion trade deficit with China. Why that's significant to Canada and the United States is a big chunk of the Chinese imports into Mexico go into products assembled for the U.S. market and for the Canadian market. Mm-hmm.
Well, and now the Obama administration is pushing for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is being negotiated by nine countries. And we have a caller on this. So let's hear from Drew in San Francisco. Hi, Drew.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Let me get you so we have a little bit better quality call. The TPP, something that you really haven't brought up in detail, is one of the very insidious parts that the TPP is very different from NAFTA because, I mean, basically free trade already exists between U.S. and many of the Asian countries. The real issue is corporate sovereignty that they're trying to introduce, which would allow corporations to basically sue countries for losses incurred because of regulation. And, I mean, it just takes things a step further. Basically, we're moving away from democracy to a corporocracy, if you want to call it that. And, you know, I hope that the Congress of the United States realizes that that's just a step too far to give corporations that kind of power. But I'd like to hear what your guests think about that.
Okay, thank you. According to Public Citizens, the TPP is NAFTA on steroids. We've done a couple shows about this. Harley, what's the status of the TPP at this point?
The status as we speak is a bit troubled in terms of its ratification. There's one preliminary step that's on the agenda right now, which is passing Trade Promotion Authority, popularly known as Fast Track, which essentially gives the president the ability to present a trade agreement to Congress. Congress can vote it up or down, but cannot amend it. Presidents have won this in the past, but Democrats in the House are lining up in opposition to this. A very highly regarded Democratic member of Congress on trade, Sander Levin from Michigan, has said he has real questions about Fast Track in its current form. Republicans are by and large for it, but there is some dissent for a variety of other reasons among the Republican caucus. So first battle that's up legislatively will be on Fast Track, and then the specifics of a trade agreement that embraces 12 countries, including several in Latin America, Mexico, Peru, Chile, and many of the countries of Asia, but not China. Then the debate will begin, I think, in earnest about TPP.
All right. Well, thank you again, Drew. And we'll put our past shows also on our website, yourcallradio.org, about TPP. We have an email from Art who says, the recent trade deals create an international structure that amounts to a global movement that puts labor and environment at a lower level than the rights of corporations. What steps can those of us at the grassroots take to elevate labor and environmental rights to equal or exceed the rights of corporations in terms of enforceable rights? Tim, what are your thoughts on that?
I think the first step is to step back from agreements like this. I mean, not passing the TPP would be a good first step. And in fact, I think it's worth noting that while NAFTA was intended, I think, by the U.S. administration to be kind of a template for rapid expansion of such trade agreements all over. They have suffered some setbacks due to popular opposition. The immediate follow-on to NAFTA was supposed to be the Free Trade Area of the Americas. That was scuttled by opposition from Brazil and other Latin American countries. There was a World Investment Agreement that was discussed that was supposed to be very much what the caller referred to, which was giving ensuring corporate rights and protection for their investments. That was scuttled. The World Trade Organization negotiations have been on hold and barely brought off life support last month with negotiations in Bali, Indonesia, on a very, very limited package. So that I think that popular opposition around the world has really slowed the development of further free trade agreements, even though we have seen some further free trade agreements passed in the United States. But I do think stepping back from that model is exactly what we need to do, and preventing the passage of further such agreements is probably right at the top of that agenda. I think Harley's point, though, that until we find a way to strengthen the bargaining power of workers and working people more generally, including farmers, and that includes the right to a decent price for their goods, you're really not going to see a fair approach to trade.
And again, the TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. A lot of critics say it's been negotiated behind closed doors, but you can find more information about it at yourcallradio.org. Gerardo Otero, Tim Wise, and Harley Shaken, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How should we adapt to a drier California? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the best way to respond to the state's drought. 2013 was California's driest calendar year on record. State water officials have yet to declare an official drought, but they are urging people to conserve water. So how should we deal with a season of no rain? Is this a temporary crisis or a long-term pattern? And how is the dry season affecting you? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is a test of the emergency alert system.